The date. The date. 1980 in Hong Kong. There was a young man named Eric. He was introduced to a 60-year-old 60-year-old Chinese man named Han. Han had this wonderful smile and the most amazing countenance about him of absolute joy, but his back was hunched over like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And he invited him into his home, and as the three of the men sat down in this sparse, tiny apartment that Han lived in, a woman brought some tea for them to enjoy. And Eric noticed that Han's eyes got even brighter the moment that she walked in. And as she served tea, their hands gently brushed one another. And he was looking at this whole thing and thought it was almost like teenagers in love. And it turned out that was his wife, May. And he noticed all of this going on, but just the fact that just he got so much brighter and filled with so much joy every time she came into the room. And Han noticed that Eric noticed and explained that he and May had just been married 2 weeks prior. The two of them began to giggle, and Han then told their story. In 1949, he had been a student. He had been a student at the Nanking Seminary. They were engaged to be married. The day before the wedding, about an hour before the rehearsal, the Chinese Communist Party came in and seized the seminary, and they took all of the students into a hard labor prison. May was allowed to visit him once every year for 1 hour. She would come in and they would talk and they would just enjoy each other's presence. And for the next 29 years, this went on. Each year, something happened. Every time as she was about to leave, the warden would ask him to renounce Jesus. And renounce him as his Lord and Savior. And if he would do that, right then and there, he could leave with May and go home. And for 29 years, he gave the same simple one-word response. No. And during the year, Han would be beaten at the warden's whim, causing him to suffer many injuries, including his hunchback. After 29 years, something amazing happened. You see, the next year was different because the warden had passed away, and the new warden decided that it wasn't worth his time or money and the cost of taking this man and keeping him there. He would allow him to go home with May. Eric was stunned at this story. And he asked, how had he been able to stand? How can you stand this strain for so long of being denied his family, his marriage, even health? Now, Han seemed absolutely astonished and shocked at this question. And he replied, "With all that Jesus has sacrificed and done for me, how could I ever betray him?" What an incredible sacrifice to make. Now, this morning, we are in the middle of Genesis 22, and we're picking up where we were last time, whatever number of weeks ago it was. We're in the middle of this amazing account. But last time we noted that there were two factors in our story. The first was we were looking at the test that God designed for Abraham. And this test was the ultimate test designed for Abraham. There's no indication that God has ever repeated this test, ever, for anybody. And boy, am I grateful for that, because if he did that for every father, whew. This was an incredible test. It was a time in Abraham's life was all about preparations for this test. This is what God was leading him up towards. And God prepares us for the circumstances and the test itself, which we will face. And none of us knows what tomorrow will bring. None of us knows when it will be our turn to face what may prove to be this ultimate test that God has given for us. For Han, it was a simple test, a question each and every year for 29 years. But we also saw how the test matches the trust that Abraham displayed. That the trust that he has in God will not only deepen with this test, but it will also serve as a great encouragement of faith to his son, Isaac. And Isaac will have a faith that is not just his parents' faith, but a faith that is now his own. A faith that he can say is because of my encounter with God. And we concluded last time with a picture of a father and a son. And the fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. And with that picture in our minds, we move on to verse 9, which says, and when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out with his hand and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. And Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. And he went over and he took the ram and he sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. And so Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day, it is said, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time. And he said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies. And though your offspring and through your offspring, all nations on the earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." And then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba. Wow. What an amazing passage, and one that I am glad it is not about me. But it certainly hits the heart, doesn't it? They went to the place that God had told him about. It was mentioned first of all in verse 4, where we read that on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He saw it in the distance and he still moved forward. He knew what he was going to do. He knew what God has asked him to do. He saw the place in the distance and he still moved towards it. He still moved forward. By the time we reach verse 9, not only has he seen the place, but now he has reached the place. And I'm not really certain that description could be any more vague. The place. It's almost like a sermon point. The place. Could you get more vague? Well, verse 9 is vague. This place was etched forever upon the mind of the Father and the Son. And there are two things that I see as so important for us, that this place, this first of all, is a place of obedience. It wasn't so much of a geographical context, even though this place, well, Calvary is located about 900 meters away from it. It's not very far away. From this exact place to Calvary is less than a kilometer. Calvary, where Christ died. Isaac was to be sacrificed. But the geography of it is not ultimately as important as the significance that this, of that which was contained in the fact that it was a place that God had told him about. He was in the place that God had told him about. He was not in the place that he took for himself. He didn't just go on a 3-day journey in a random direction and wandered until he felt like, oh, well, this is the place. He went exactly where God had directed him to go. As a man, I can't fathom how Abraham could do such a thing. Who would take his child, his only child, on such an adventure as this? Who would do that? I have three boys, and not a single one of them I would want to take on this journey. Come on, boys, let's go. We're going to go for a three-day hike. And when we get to the top of the mountain, oh, something's going to happen. What man wants to do that to his son? Abraham isn't a hero, but he is an obedient man of faith. And he messed up a lot throughout his life. But Abraham is an example to us because eventually he came to the place of obedience. And I came across a question this week. How much more would we discover the abundance of God's love and of the adequacy of God's provisions if only we would daily ensure one thing, that we are walking on the pathway of obedience? How much more would we experience if we did that? In John chapter 14, Jesus says this, "If you love me, you will obey what I command." That's it. If you love, obey. It should be simple enough, isn't it? A few verses later in John chapter 15, Jesus says this, "If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands, and I remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be complete." Do you want to be a joyful believer? Christianity is actually not a feeling. Yet too often we say, "I feel like praying," or "I feel like it's time to worship," or "I feel like this." But the scripture tells us, obey and be filled with joy. We can be filled with all sorts of theology and knowledge and wisdom, and yet if we don't obey, then we're not in the place that God has told us about, the place of obedience. And that's where he wants each and every one of us to be. Obedience is hard when we don't have the details. But Abraham obeyed without the details. Are you in the region of obedience this morning? Are you in the place where God may speak? Where he's going to speak to your heart and lead you forward? I remember when I was in my senior year at Bible college. It was a tough year for me. And I had met with some of the leaders at the school and trying to find a church that I could serve in. And finally, because I stopped listening to them and listened to what will become my wife, she said, "Well, why don't you apply at my church? They're not looking for anybody." I said, "Well, I've applied everywhere else. Why not?" And so I met with some of the leaders of this church for the very first time, and I talked with a few board members and with the pastor, and they let me know that they would let me know Someday we'll let you know what our decision is. And a month passed, and I finished my last exam at Briarcrest. My school was now finished. What am I supposed to do? I don't know. Don't know where I'm supposed to go. And so Jess and I headed back to Alberta, where she would meet my parents for the first time. I didn't know what was to come. I didn't know the direction that I was supposed to go. I didn't know that by the end of that week, I would be moving to Winnipeg for the rest of my life. I was willing to go. God did the rest. And on May 1st, 1994, I began to serve here. And God has been so good. And He has blessed. And it has been absolutely wonderful. This place that Abraham came to, it was not only a place of obedience, but it was also a place of sacrifice. Can you see it? A father and a son embraced in conversation, embraced in one another's love, and carrying between them the material for a sacrifice. Both the offerer and the offering walking together. And it seems to me that obedience and sacrifice on that pathway of faith cannot be separated. If you know nothing about sacrifice, then I'm not sure you know anything about faith. Because they cannot be separated. Sacrifice is at faith's beginning. Jesus said to the crowd in Luke chapter 9, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." And gradually, the crowds that heard this, they got smaller and smaller and smaller. He was in the business of creating faithful, obedient disciples. He didn't call people to the lowest common denominator. He made it as difficult as possible for them to get on the pathway of faith, and yet he made it as easy as possible at the same time. If you want to come, die, then come and you will live in obedience. And then you will live in sacrifice. And not only did he teach it, he lived it. There is sacrifice. There is a transformation. There's a cost involved to following Jesus. What does it cost to follow Jesus Christ? What does it cost us to walk the pathway of faith here in Winnipeg? Or Eli, or wherever you're from. Are our lives a living sacrifice offered to God? I don't know what He is calling you to do, but are you willing and ready to obey? Are you sure that you are being what He wants you to be. Now, if you are, then God bless you. And let's get on with it. But if you are not, then it's time to make that sacrifice and move on with God. Because today is the day of salvation. Amen? But thank God that in this place of obedience and sacrifice, we must see the provisions that God will make. And when they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out with his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Sorry. I have tried from a human point of view to envision how can this take place? And the only way this happens is if Isaac embraced what was happening and not just his father's. That Isaac embraced his father's faith. That he embraced his father's God. And after much digging into this passage, and I think we need to readjust our mental picture. Did you know that Isaac may have been as old as 37 years old? Now, I don't know how old he was, but I'm picturing him as 20 years old because they keep calling him a boy and not a man. He's almost old enough to be 21, but Isaac may be 37 since the very next event in chapter 23 is Sarah's death, and Sarah dies at 127. And giving birth at 90, that makes Abraham as old as 37 years of age. Isaac is involved in this whole process. Abraham loved his son, his only son. I cannot fathom and I cannot picture that Abraham is building the altar and getting the wood put into place, and then he walks up behind his son and bangs him on the back of the head so he's unconscious, so he can bind him. It doesn't fit the narrative. I can't picture a man who is over 100 years of age wrestling a 20-some-year-old. It doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't say that he struggled and that he fought with Isaac. But if Isaac went willingly by himself, then it is clear that Abraham had communicated effectively to his son the great faith that welled up within his heart, that the Lord will provide. I don't know how he's going to do that, but I am sure that he's going to do it. Son, because you are the very central part of his purpose for the future. They may have spoken about how God may do this, either by substitution or perhaps they knew of resurrection, something that had never occurred in the world yet, something that they never even heard of. But, I mean, we're pretty creative. Maybe God could raise him from the dead or something. I don't know what that conversation was. But the word is silent, and it doesn't say. But it does say that he reached out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham, here I am." You notice he quickly responds, "Here I am. Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now that I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." And Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. There is the provision that God has brought. Do we have as strong a conviction of God's ability to provide as Abraham had? Do we have that? As the angel intervenes, we discover that the provision of the ram was appropriate in its timing. I'm not sure he could have waited any longer with that provision, but the timing was absolutely perfect. It was adequate for the task. That ram was just perfect for the task. Isaac was quickly replaced by the lamb. Can you imagine how fast, as a father, it would have been? There's a ram stuck there. My son is bound to the altar. Quick, I've got a knife. I can cut him loose. Quick, let's get to life. How fast they must have moved. The relief, the joy, the absolute of that moment. I don't know what Abraham was like. But Isaac, you got to help with this because I am in tears. That God has provided, that Jehovah Jireh appeared. The Lord will provide. Then there's the whole blessing thing that we've gone through a few times, that out and through Isaac, there's going to be this blessing of descendants more numerous than stars and sand and all this stuff. And God has said this to Abraham, but now Isaac is hearing it. But then in verse 19, then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba. This verse really, it bugged me this week. I didn't like it. Abraham and Isaac, the father and the son, they go together. Abraham and Isaac, Abraham and Isaac, Abraham and Isaac. But now Abraham returns to the servants. Where is Isaac? Why is he not mentioned? It doesn't say that Isaac returned. It's quite entirely possible that Isaac needed and wanted to sit up there for a while to ponder and wonder the provisions of God. Maybe Isaac needed a moment alone with God, without dad. Stop and think about all of this. You're Isaac. Your father bound you, placed you upon the altar to sacrifice you because God had asked him to do it. I think I might need a moment by myself, if I was Isaac, to allow these events to be processed in his heart and in his mind. Maybe he said, Dad, you go on yourself. I need to stay. I need to think this through. I need time to be with God myself right now. Have we thought through the wonder of God's provisions in our lives? Or do we just take them as they come and go, that's great, I've got what I need? Do we even recognize that these provisions are from God? And that brings us to the picture that is contained within these verses. Because this account in Genesis, this incident in Genesis 22, points us forward, about 2,000 years forward, to the sacrifice of Jesus upon Calvary. Because this event is a foreshadowing of what one day will happen between God the Father and God the Son. And there are a few parallels that I want us to take a look at this morning, and I'm sure that there are more that we don't have time to look at. But let's look at a couple of them. First of all, if you think of verse 6 with Abraham taking the wood and placing it upon his son Isaac, so that Isaac can carry the wood that last little bit. To me, this is a clear foreshadowing of the wooden cross that Jesus carries to Calvary, that Jesus was bearing on his back the wood on which would be used for the sacrifice. The sacrifice that he was about to make. And as Isaac moved forward, bearing this wood, he foreshadows one who, at a much later time, would bear upon himself that which would be the symbol of his sacrifice, the cross. And in the same verse, you have the combination of Isaac bearing the wood and Abraham, the father, carrying the fire and the knife. And in Isaiah chapter 53, in verse 7, where it speaks of Jesus, as he offered himself up, it says, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before the shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. We have the picture there of the submission of the Son. But in verse 10, we have this awesome picture of the activity of the Father, where it says, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering. He will see his offspring and prolong his days. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. You see, the atonement that Christ accomplished on the cross was not something brought into history to fix a defect. God didn't create with a defect. A defect that they later realized, oh, we've got to fix this defect. So how are we going to do that? And the Father and the Son sat down and decided to hash it out over the next few hundred years. How are we going to fix this? How are we going to fix this? That wasn't what happened. The atonement was written into the eternal purposes of God so that we see the offering of Jesus submissively. By the same token, we see the activity of God the Father in those awesome words. It was the will of God to crush him. There is the foreshadowing of the substitutionary death. See, Isaac asked, the wood is here, the fire is here, but where is the lamb? Can you hear the words of John the Baptist reverberating down through the ages as he looks at Jesus, as he stands in the river and he declares boldly, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." And the timing of the provision of the ram was so perfect. And so too was the timing of Christ's offering up. When Paul writes in Romans chapter 5, you see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Not a moment too soon, not a moment too late. The angel's voice sounded in the heavens. And the child was brought forth. And not a moment too soon, not a moment too late, the sky was covered in darkness. And the cry went out and up from that wee baby that was born, who is now 30 some years later, as he hangs on the cross and says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Not a moment too soon, not a moment too late. And the trumpet will sound, and that trumpet sound will pierce the sky, and he will come to those who are ready to meet him. Perhaps today, that trumpet will sound. And so today I must ask once again, have you come to the place of obedience? It's not a geographical location. It is a place within your heart. Have you come to the place of obedience? Have you come to the place of sacrifice? Do you rejoice in the provisions that God has made? Are you part of the picture that is painted in these verses? What good is a faith that deserts us at the moment of our ultimate challenge? Jehovah Jireh is my provider. His grace is sufficient for me. For my God shall supply all my needs according to his riches and glory. He gives his angels charge over me because Jehovah Jireh cares for me. For me. And for you. Man, that sounds like a great song to sing, don't you think? Do you guys know that song, Jehovah Jireh? I heard this song for the very first time. I believe it was in 1990. A little bit different than we're going to do it this morning, but team, if you can come forward and let's sing this song, Jehovah Jireh. The version that I first heard was heavy metal, so it's not going to be anything like we're going to do. But man, this song is such a powerful song. Jehovah Jireh, my provider. His grace is sufficient for me this morning.